Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, who assesses Russia's escalating military role in Syria's civil war. Marla Markham, who talks about the Climate Disobedience Center, which she co-founded, that serves as a catalyst for direct action and provides support for activists who engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. And People for the American Way senior researcher Miranda Blue, who discusses her new report that links Operation Rescue and the group that released doctored videos to discredit Planned Parenthood. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after the Ebola outbreak killed over 11,000 people in West Africa, the health emergency was recently declared over in Sierra Leone, a hotspot of the epidemic. The last case involved an 8-month-old child who lived in a slum in the capital city of Freetown. The year-long Ebola epidemic left Sierra Leone's health system in shambles and raised major questions about the ability of the World Health Organization to prevent a new disease outbreak in the poor African nations of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. According to The Guardian, the regional office for WHO operations in West Africa failed to contain Ebola by pressing national health ministries into action. It took months for WHO to diagnose the first case of Ebola in Guinea, and as Ebola spread to neighboring countries, WHO failed to declare a full-scale health emergency. In early August 2014, WHO Director Margaret Chan finally acted when confronted by Doctors Without Borders President Joanne Liu. Barbara Stocking, a former president of Oxfam, led an independent investigation of WHO's Ebola response, which concluded that the health agency's top executives lacked courageous decision-making and failed to communicate effectively with field staff. Under pressure from public health advocates, WHO Director Chan has promised to create a new system for future health emergencies by building a global network of emergency volunteers who could respond within hours to the next health crisis. As a teenager in Pittsford, Vermont, David Blittersdorf built his first wind turbine. Today, he runs his own wind power company that delivers clean, renewable energy to more than 4,000 homes. Today, 100% of the power used in Vermont's largest city, Burlington, comes from renewable sources. Vermont is also the only state in the continental United States to be exempted from President Obama's Clean Power Plan, since the Green Mountain State has already surpassed the program's goal of 45% of its power coming from renewable sources. Rob Sargent, who runs the energy program for Environment America, told the Christian Science Monitor Vermont is a model for the biggest thing that needs to be done, to set aggressive goals and get people to link arms and achieve them. Back in the 1970s, Burlington's electric department relied on an old, dirty coal power plant. Instead of building a new coal plant, the city invested in a biomass plant that burned wood chips, a local natural resource. Now the city's current biomass plant is the largest electric producer in the state. Today the plant generates 45% of the city's electricity and is a net zero carbon emitter. Vermonters have taken steps that could show the way for other states, from how it sells clean power to neighboring polluters to how it changed the way its power grid is run. Under pressure from the Republican Congress to balance its books, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, which runs the Federal Housing Administration, has, since 2010, been packaging thousands of non-performing home mortgages and selling them to private investors at a huge discount. Housing advocates maintain HUD, which is tasked with creating strong communities and affordable housing, is instead facilitating a massive transfer of wealth from working families to wealthy hedge fund investors under the Distressed Assets Stabilization Program. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who together with HUD directly or indirectly insure 70% of the country's mortgages, began similar sales this summer. The Center for Public Integrity concluded that thus far the program has failed to prevent most homeowners from being driven into foreclosure. A quarterly report on the program from 2014 found only 11% of homeowners whose mortgages were sold in the federal program were still making mortgage payments. Diane Cipollone, a consultant with the National Fair Housing Alliance, observed, "The investors are out to make money. They are not there to do neighborhood revitalization or neighborhood stabilization." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The brutal civil war in Syria has thus far claimed the lives of an estimated 250,000 people, while creating millions of internal and external refugees seeking safe haven from the conflict in the Middle East and across Europe. After 4.5 years of war, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whose regime has been condemned for its indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, has in recent months lost ground to both Western-backed opposition rebel groups and ISIS. Russia, a longtime ally of Syria, has now joined the conflict with the goal of bolstering Assad's weakened military. Russian airstrikes carried out by sophisticated fighter jets, along with the deployment of tanks and armored personnel carriers, has been criticized by the U.S. and NATO for supporting a regime whose ruthless tactics, they say, triggered the armed rebellion in 2011. They further charge that Russia has not targeted ISIS, but Western-backed rebel groups. Russian officials have rejected the charge and maintain that their targets are ISIS, al-Nusra, and other terrorist groups. Conflicting reports on the future deployment of Russian ground troops into Syria and their warplanes' recent violation of Turkish airspace has ratcheted up tensions. Your reporter spoke with Chris Tensing, executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of their publication Middle East Report. Here he assesses the possible consequences of Russia's escalating military role in Syria's civil war and prospects for a negotiated end to the conflict.
External intervention almost always just prolongs the conflict because it increases the belief of the proxy combatants in the civil war itself that they can prevail. It increases their confidence that they can win. And I think that is still what's happening here. Certainly the narrative was Syrian regime was on the ropes. Even Hezbollah was starting to desert it, that it was having real problems recruiting people to fight on the battlefield, and that by default, various insurgencies were gaining ground. And so therefore, the Russian intervention has basically not only strengthened the regime militarily, but also stiffened its resolve. And so I think unless this is a break from the pattern, which I don't see why it would be yet. The response, we've already seen it from the U.S., and it's coming from the Saudis too, the response will be escalation on the part of the outside powers that back the insurgencies against the Assad regime, and it'll strengthen the same logic there. And so, again, there are no good guys, and the victims are the Syrian people who have to somehow survive as various foes of theirs, foreign and domestic, act out their own agendas on Syrian land.
What, if any, common ground exists between Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, the United States, and the NATO countries when it comes to Syria that could lay the groundwork for some future negotiations that could end this conflict?
Well, as one of my colleagues, Daryl Lee, put it, the problem with Syria and with Iraq too, the territory that is controlled by the so-called Islamic State. The problem is that everyone hates ISIS, but everyone fears something else more. So their fear of something else is greater than their hatred of ISIS. And that's why they're not willing to do what it takes, quote unquote, to remove the threat of ISIS. With Turkey, that's the Kurds. You know, you could run down the list of actors and come up with the thing that they are more concerned about than they are about ISIS itself. So the diplomatic challenge, if we could imagine a supranational body, I don't know, the UN maybe, that sincerely had not only this mandate but also this intent to find this diplomatic common ground, the game would be to convince the various external and domestic actors, you know, so also the Assad regime and the other components of the Syrian opposition, both armed and unarmed, that their fear of ISIS ought to be their number one priority and that these other things are secondary. Again, history is just not terribly encouraging with respect to that agenda. It's tremendously difficult. The war, not just in Syria, but the war in Yemen too, wars across the region, the situation in Libya, all of these pose incredibly thorny and complex challenges to not just the left, but to anybody who is really concerned about international peace and security and about the future of the people in the region. These questions are not easy, and if we pretend they are, we're not doing anybody any favors.
One of the factors in this conflict in Syria is the Sunni-Shia divide, and members of the Alawite minority in Syria, many of them are convinced that there will be mass slaughter if Bashar al-Assad should leave power, and they believe that all that stands between them and death and genocide is this horrible regime. But what are some of your thoughts about how that bridge can be crossed if there is to be a negotiated settlement?
Well, what you said about the Alawites is exactly right, and it is pretty much the core explanation for why the regime has survived throughout all of these nine circles of hell. And the fear that you mentioned is not irrational. There have been numerous documented cases of sectarian massacres of Alawis, of Christians, of Sunni Muslims, of pretty much everyone, Kurds as well. How does one address it? Well, Syrians themselves are largely addressing it with their feet. They're leaving the country en masse and have been for years. But there is goodwill that does still exist. There are still many, many Syrians who have not just an anti-sectarian vision for their country, but a non-sectarian vision for their country, a pluralistic one. That is to say that it's not just that they reject sectarian rhetoric and sectarian thinking, but that they actively have a proactive and positive agenda for transcending that kind of discourse and that kind of practice in the future. Those people are the hope of the country. And the question is how to empower them. And before they get empowered, they have to be made part of the political equation again in a way that they were in the early days of the uprising. They were the most important part of the equation in the early days of the uprising in 2011. And the regime robbed them of that on purpose by reacting with such disproportionate, vicious force is the word to use. The only way to return those Syrians who are the solution, ultimately, to their own country's problem is to end the fighting as soon as possible and with a minimum of additional damage to Syria, the country, and Syria, the people.
That was Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report. Find more news and analysis of recent events in Syria by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Four activists who have carried out creative acts of nonviolent direct action have banded together to form a new organization called the Climate Disobedience Center. Acting from their deeply held faith perspectives, these four individuals, Tim DeChristopher, Jay O'Hara, Ken Ward, and Marla Markham, are launching the center to inspire activists to take similar risks for climate justice and generate support for those who do. That would include pursuit of a necessity defense in court, in which activists charged with a violation of the law claim their actions were necessary to prevent a greater harm, like runaway climate change. Tim DeChristopher served 21 months in prison after being convicted of fraudulently bidding on gas and oil leases offered in Utah at the end of the George W. Bush administration. Even though the auction for those parcels was declared illegal by the incoming Obama administration, Obama's Justice Department still chose to prosecute DeChristopher. O'Hara and Ward piloted a lobster boat to block a 40,000-ton coal shipment to a Massachusetts power plant in 2013 and faced trial the following year. Markham is a longtime climate activist who has organized a number of protest actions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Marla Markham during a recent New England climate activist organizers retreat. Here she explains the rationale for their new group and what they hope to accomplish.
One thing that happened over the course of working together, and especially seeing through Ken and Jay's action to trial, was a recognition that if we do our actions in ways that don't demonize people, but really focus on trying to shift systems and recognizing that we're all stuck in the same system and trying to give people an opportunity to use whatever power they have to access the movement, then we can bring new people into the work. So, for example, on the day of Ken and Jay's trial in Fall River, Massachusetts, we had turned out about 140 supporters, roughly 47 of them clergy wearing their collars. And we had a lot of contingency plans for the day. We didn't know what would happen. In fact, we had bought another boat, and there was a boat parked moored down at the pier, ready to go. We assumed that the DA was going to drop the charges that day, and we were then going to pay whatever fines and go get in the boat and do it again. So we had a plan for that. We had a plan for if we went all the way through the trial and they were convicted and taken straight to jail, which was unlikely, but we had a plan for that. The only thing we didn't plan for was the DA being on our side. And that's the thing that happened. So we began to recognize when we thought about it afterward that what we had done was given him an opportunity to use the power that he has to be part of making some change in the movement. Normally, he doesn't have any access with his institutional power to the movement at all. And when we put him in a position where he had to think about what he was going to do and what was right and wrong and what he could do from his position, he made a choice that we had forgotten to expect of our elected leaders. So I like to say that one of the gifts that Sam Sutter gave to us as the district attorney of Bristol County was that he reminded us that we need to ask more of our elected leaders. We had forgotten to ask them to lead. We had forgotten to even expect that they might think to do it. And so we decided that we wanted to keep working together to try to support people to take actions that really give more and more people an opportunity to make a choice. So we're trying to support actions that create moral tension that's really public and really simple, and that we see all the way through to trial so that we can use necessity defense.
Just say a little bit more about what the DA actually said and what he did right after he dropped the charges.
So when Sam Sutter started talking, he said something like, climate change is the most pressing threat of our time or something. And he went on to say that the decision that he had made to drop the charges and, you know, ask us to pay for the overtime spent by the police was taken with the taxpayers of Bristol County in mind, but also with the future of their children and their children's children in mind. And then he went on to say that he was going to march with us in the People's Climate March in about 2 weeks later. And he did. He marched pretty much the whole People's Climate March with us.
That's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, and he brought his staff and his family with him. And then another extraordinary thing that happened is that the mayor of Fall River was recalled shortly after that, and Sam decided to run for mayor, and he's now the mayor of Fall River.
The name is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Climate Disobedience Center. How did you come up with that? And explain how that fits into what you explained is the goal of the organization.
Yeah, so we really want to be building a culture of resistance, because the powers that keep us stuck in the systems that we're all stuck in aren't going to change because it's the right thing to do. They're only going to change with the application of some real resistance and power from regular folks like us. And we have to build a culture of resistance. And so we were talking about wanting to prioritize supporting civil disobedience actions. And we just got to the, and we know we want to focus on climate, so we just landed on climate disobedience as a phrase, and decided that we would be the Climate Disobedience Center. And we think it's really important for people who want to take higher legal risk actions and see them through to trial and really risk, perhaps, as Tim did, prison time for their cause, that we think it's really important for those people to have the resources to support that effort, to be able to have folks who help them build a support team around them, to have folks who help their lawyers understand the necessity defense and how these folks want their cases to be part of a movement action, and they don't just want to get off as quickly as they can. They actually want to use it as part of their action. So we hope to help build support teams, help people prepare sort of emotionally and spiritually for the long work of uncertainty that comes with putting yourself in that position, and to make sure that they have people around them who bring in more and more people to support them.
That was Marla Markham, a co-founder of the new Climate Disobedience Center. For more information on the center and its mission, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The latest flashpoint for a Republican-led threat to shut down the U.S. federal government is centered around the GOP and its anti-abortion allies campaign to defund Planned Parenthood. A government shutdown was averted when a stopgap funding bill was signed by President Obama on September 30th, but that only postpones the threat of a shutdown until December 11th, when the temporary funding bill expires. The effort to deny Planned Parenthood federal funds began last summer, when a group called the Center for Medical Progress released a series of covertly made videos that accused Planned Parenthood staff of harvesting aborted human body parts and illegally selling fetal tissue to medical researchers for profit. Allegations of illegal conduct featured in the deceptively edited videos, as well as statements from David Dalidon, founder of the Center for Medical Progress, have been widely debunked. Following the release of the videos, six states launched investigations into Planned Parenthood's activities and cleared the organization of any wrongdoing. Your reporter spoke with People for the American Way senior researcher Miranda Blue, who discusses her new report titled Operation Rescue's Big Break, how an organization rooted in the radical fringes of the anti-choice movement is threatening to shut down the government.
This summer, a group called the Center for Medical Progress began releasing a series of videos from an undercover operation that had set up a fake medical company to infiltrate Planned Parenthood. And they claimed that these videos show that Planned Parenthood was violating federal laws about donating fetal tissue for medical research. And those claims have been pretty well debunked. A number of six states have now closed investigations and found no wrongdoing.
The accusation that Planned Parenthood is selling fetal tissue for research and making a profit at it has been debunked. But maybe you could explain the accusations being made a little bit more and where the truth lies and how we know that the truth is not on the side of the accusers here.
Right. So in 1993, Congress passed a law that allowed the use of fetal tissue that comes from elective abortions to be used for medical research. And this has been used for a lot of research on diseases including Parkinson's. It's sometimes used for vaccine development. And that's a separate ethical debate, whether fetal tissue research should be legal. And I think that's a legitimate ethical debate, but that's not the debate that these folks are trying to have. It's interesting that since this law was passed in 1993, a number of anti-abortion groups have tried to use the fetal tissue research as a wedge issue to get at abortion providers, and especially at Planned Parenthood. What the law says is that you can't profit from the sale of fetal tissue, so you can charge for the expenses that it takes to get it to someone, but you can't profit off of it. And it's pretty clear from the videos that the Center for Medical Progress has released that that isn't actually what was happening at Planned Parenthood. They edited out a bunch of instances of Planned Parenthood officials very explicitly saying that they weren't profiting from this. So this is a option that is given to women at a very small number of Planned Parenthood clinics to voluntarily donate fetal tissue, and that they don't profit off it. They abide by federal law. But this is something that I think anti-abortion groups have seen as a possible wedge issue for a long time. In 1999, a group called Life Dynamics in Texas, which is where the Center for Medical Progress says that they got the idea for their Planned Parenthood smear, tried to do something very similar with abortion clinics in Texas, and that investigation fell apart when the mole that they had placed in a medical procurement company admitted before Congress that he had made up parts of his story. And then in 2008, Operation Rescue, which is a big group behind the Center for Medical Progress, tried to get a Planned Parenthood clinic outside of Kansas City investigated for fetal tissue donation violations, and that was baseless as well.
Well, just a final question here for you, and this is probably an important issue at the root of all this, and that is, what do we know about public opinion on Planned Parenthood and its receiving federal fund? Do we know whether or not this controversy and these many false accusations that have been issued by these groups and by politicians have made any dent in support for Planned Parenthood and its mission?
Well, about a week ago, a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll showed that the public support for Planned Parenthood had actually remained steady throughout this whole thing, that about 60% of Americans still support having federal funding for Planned Parenthood, which is important to note. Federal funding does not go to abortions through Planned Parenthood. This is Medicaid reimbursements for women's health care. And actually, one thing that the poll found was that Planned Parenthood at this point has more support than the Republican Party. So it's still, I think that people understand what Planned Parenthood does and what it does not. And especially, you know, women who have taken advantage of the services that Planned Parenthood offers. I know that I am one of them. And I think it's hard to convince people who have gotten medical care from Planned Parenthood that it's actually secretly an evil organization, which is what they're trying to do. I think that people kind of see through the goal of these videos, and people appreciate Planned Parenthood for what it does.
That was People for the American Way senior researcher Miranda Blue. Find links to Miranda's report on Operation Rescue, the Center for Medical Progress, and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.